progress has been great across the board. We're doing now, we're selling over $50,000 a day worth of home renovation.
Hi, welcome to the Founders with Pet podcast, where I interview amazing entrepreneurs from diverse backgrounds about their journeys, successes, failures, and lessons along the way. In this episode, we have Roger Dickey. He's the CEO founder of Made Renovation, a home renovation company backed by Founders Fund. Prior to that, Roger founded Gigster. I was actually a very early adopter when I first heard about Gigster. I actually tried out Gigster just to see how it would impact, you know, the agency that I have. And so Gigster, kind of that aside, serves 10% of, at one point, the Fortune 500, raised $32 million from folks including Andreessen Horowitz, Redpoint Ventures, NBA legend Michael Jordan. Prior to that, Roger had an agency, CuriosSoft, Austin-based gaming studio that operated 20-plus Facebook apps, generating 300 million-plus views in Facebook. After an acquisition by Zing, Roger went on to found Mafia Wars, and I played Mafia Wars. That certainly took a lot of my time. Grew that to 100 million users plus, and Fishville, and I also played, yeah, I played the other Vills. But yeah, welcome to the show. It's great to finally catch up.
Thanks for having me. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. So tell us about your new thing. So this is not like an all technology platform. There's, you know, you're doing bathroom renovations and remodeling.
That's right. Yeah. Turns out bathrooms are a huge market. It's an $80 billion market for home renovations just in bathrooms, another $80 billion for kitchens. And there's weren't really any technology companies going after. Yeah. I mean, backstory is my co-founder and I both really into consumer, both wanted to do kind of a tech-enabled operations company. And I'm actually a personal kind of, you know, my personal hobby is carpentry. It's been a great COVID thing to kind of use my hands and get away from screens. So, you know, we were just looking at industries where we could build a much better consumer experience and bring it online. And we stumbled on home renovation. And there's this cool trend, especially during COVID, because we're all stuck at home, where people are buying more and more high ticket items online. You know, so people are buying used cars off Carvana, you know, people are buying these $4,000 Peloton bikes, you know, and like the mirror and stuff like that. So, you know, we kind of thought, why wouldn't someone someday buy a home renovation? And we're really big believers in that. And that's like built right into our mission statement, is that we want, you know, we want to build a, you know, super simple, great service where people can push a button and literally just like transform their home. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a cool ride the last 2 years, and a lot of success.
Yeah. So many things people are buying online that you never thought before. You know, I never thought people would buy shoes online, you know, because it's something that's very personal and you feel like you have to
try it on.
But, you know, Zappos just let you, you know, an early user of Zappos would, you know, buy like, you know, 8.5, 9, and 9.5 shoes of the same pair, right? And then just buy all three, and then just return the one that didn't fit. That was an interesting. How's the startup going? It's about two years in. Tell us about the traction.
Yeah, so we're at about 100 employees, and then we've got a number of contractors that are mostly interior designers and architects. That's kind of a separate group that, you know, comes in and helps with customer projects. We also have a bunch of great local general contractors. I think there's about 100 partners that we have across San Francisco and Los Angeles. We're about to launch a new city. We're actually about to announce our Series A as well. We raised a $16 million round, and, you know, raised it from some cool people. So that should be coming out shortly, in a couple of weeks. But yeah, I mean, progress has been great across the board. We're doing now, we're selling over $50,000 a day worth of home renovation. So a lot of sales. And we have incredible executive team. I think we have 5 or 6 people at the VP level now at the company who are, you know, great at kind of all the different trades that go into building a bathroom. It's a fairly complex company because it's, you know, it's tech-enabled operations. There's a technology side. There's also the operations side. There's also this kind of new like marketing and product challenge of selling, you know, a $30,000 item, you know, mostly online. So there's a lot of, you know, artistry that had to go into designing the flow for how customers can get their quote and, you know, see a 3D render and preview the bathroom and things like that, all the way through, you know, it's a 3-month experience to deliver the bathroom between the design, the material purchasing, and the construction. So there's just a lot of parts to it. And, you know, it's, you know, we always tell ourselves we're, you know, it's tough business, but we're getting 1% better every day. So yeah, it's been good. And I'm really proud of what we've done and excited for more expansion soon.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's a high ticket service item, you know, something like $30,000 where it's an intangible good that you don't get immediately. Like, you know, people understand a $30,000 Tesla, you know, they know what they're going to get because, and it's ready made. So the risk is low. How do you overcome some of these? Yeah. Imagine just kind of like how Airbnb had to overcome, you know, hey, staying at a stranger's home. Like, how do you overcome some of these objections and what were some of your learnings?
Yeah. Good question. I mean, people, you know, thankfully there is familiarity in the market to, you know, to purchasing a home renovation. I mean, the way it's typically done is people will contact, you know, they'll, you know, call maybe 5 or 6 general contractors, try to get a couple bids, a couple people come out to their house, you know, then they'll move forward. And then, you know, with that, they'll sign with the general contractor, but then they'll do a lot of the kind of setup part up front, you know, so they have to, and they have to do that themselves. So they're, you know, going through Pinterest boards and they're taking 10 or 15 trips to the tile store and to Home Depot and looking at materials and, you know, kind of project managing it and ordering everything. And, you know, I think there's 45 different parts that go into a bathroom typically. So, I mean, imagine how many packages that is. Imagine how many times you have to answer the door. So we just looked at, you know, kind of all the complexity that went into that. And we tried to package it as this like all-in-one service. And when you talk to our customers, that's what they say they like. And, you know, when they're looking at our marketing materials and considering going with us versus a typical contractor, they really said that they like that. So, you know, part of how we sell it and how we get over that hump you talked about is we talk about how, hey, this is a new way to renovate. And, you know, a lot of our customers are these kind of early adopter types. Some of them work in tech. A lot of them that I talk to, you know, either the husband or the wife has a job in tech. So they see us and they're like, oh, it's a startup. And they kind of understand that that means innovation. It means doing it a better way. And it means that, you know, the company's funded and that they're gonna have a better experience. So we were able to play that, I think, to our advantage.
Got it. Were there it's also, you know, thinking of it that it's a high ticket service, were there any learnings that you pulled from Gigster? Because essentially that's what Gigster was, is high ticket, you know, service.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I've joked that this is Gigster for bathrooms.
There you go.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, if you look at the early days of Gigster, when we, you know, we were selling smaller projects in the $20,000 to $30,000 range, which, you know, as someone who runs an agency, you know that when you're working with enterprise, it's much larger numbers, which we eventually got to with Gigster. But the early days were these like smaller $20,000 to $30,000 deals. With this company, it's, you know, that's what everything looks like, because we only do bathrooms. We don't do anything else. And I think that focus is super important. The idea that we're not doing, you know, kitchens and, you know, skylights and, you know, whole home renovations and stuff like that. But yeah, no, it there definitely are similarities to Gigster. I would say the sales team and the way that we've built kind of how sales and marketing works looks a little bit like early days Gigster. The flow that customers use to kind of get a quote and talk to a sales rep, I would say, looks similar. Even the delivery time period's about the same. I mean, for a $20,000 to $30,000 deal, you know, or development gig, you can deliver that in 1 or 2 months, maybe 3 months. It's a little longer with a bathroom. But yeah, there are a striking number of similarities between home renovation and software services.
Yeah. What compelled you to start Gigster?
Start Gigster?
Yeah.
With Gigster, let's see. So rewind the clock to 2013, which is when we were thinking about ideas. So I had left Zynga in 2011 and I started an investment just to kind of meet founders and have an excuse to go out to coffee a bunch of times and just invest in smart people that I meet. And also just to learn about a lot of new markets. Like, one of the fun things about being an investor is, you know, you might get pitched like some idea that you've never even imagined. Like, I met this amazing founder who was doing a gasoline delivery company based in, and I was like, well, why is that interesting? And it turns out that a lot of buildings have gas generators and the electricity can go out a lot. So you need to have trucks driving around and constantly filling up these gas generators. And that's apparently a huge market. And now the company's doing extremely well, you know? So you meet all these really interesting founders going after interesting niche problems that can end up being huge businesses. So that got me, you know, I was kind of a gaming guy, but doing all that investing got, you know, kind of made me aware of these other problems that exist in the world. And we actually raised money for what I call a search lab. And if you look up Roger Dickey's Search Lab on Google, you can find my Medium, and I've got some posts on what that is. But high level, you raise money with the intent to experiment with different startup ideas. So they're not pivots, because you're experimenting. And you try out, you launch three or four different mini startups that each have their own marketing budget, their own, you know, R&D budget, their own website, their own initial audience, you know, user research. You launch three or four of those, and you see which one really hits and takes off. And then you cancel everything else. You pour all your remaining resources into that idea. And then once you grow to a certain level, you raise a Series A. And then it looks like any other startup from then on. So that's the exact model we pursued previous to Gigster. The search lab was called Liquid Lab. And actually the search lab that found Made Renovation was called Untitled Labs. So I did the same thing again. But we looked at a bunch of ideas. And I still remember the traction from Gigster. When we launched it, within 2 days, I think we had $2 or $3 million worth of business that was submitted onto the website. So I say that we had a form where you're like, I think it's the website said, hire a quality developer in 5 minutes, click here. You click the button and then it's like, hey, what's your name? What's your email address? How big is your project? What's your budget roughly? And then you go to a live chat with me or my co-founder, and that was it. And when you add up all those numbers in the database, it was millions of dollars of work. So there was a lot of interest. You know, a lot of people wanted to just push a button and hire a great developer. When we saw that track, it was clear we had some product market fit. And that's actually the way that I think Michael Seibel, that's his definition for product market fit, is it's an overwhelming influx of demand. Like, we were sitting there and our phone, we had this Twilio thing on our phone where it would beep whenever we got, that it would buzz whenever we got a new lead. Our phones were just blowing up. It was pretty obvious people liked it.
Right. It was the product market fit just hits you in the face. I think the way he describes it, there's no mistaking. That's amazing. I guess that makes sense why you did it. You know, you explored that idea and it was like, what were the other ideas?
Oh man. Actually, I think my Medium post might have a list. it's crazy. So we had this one idea we had this thing called like Any Expert, and you could go there and you could get like video experts that would chat with you. And then after that, we're like, okay, well, let's pick one use case. And my parents were recently divorced. And I think they expressed to me that it was like really weird dating when you're in your like late 50s, early 60s, and you're, you know, trying to meet somebody new. So we actually made a site called Date Coach that was designed for people who were in their 50s, who were divorced. And we had around 100 marriage and family therapists that we recruited. We just cold emailed people off Yelp. And we built this whole platform of dating experts. And then I think that didn't work. I think we didn't really try that hard enough, because we're like, we don't really like this as much as we thought. And man, and then we tried so many other things. Yeah, just a very, very long list.
Yeah. I'd love to understand maybe the decision-making process or framework. What were the criteria that, you know, aside from, you know, the Gigster idea, kind of just, you know, the Twilio thing just ringing nonstop, what were some of the, you know, the process, you know, kind of first principles that you apply to kind of pick the right idea?
So as a founder, you know, and even as a startup employee, it's important to remember that you're an investor. It's important to keep that in mind, but you're actually more important than an investor, because you're investing your time and your life and your youth and your career, years of your career, into this idea, this upstart that may or may not amount to anything. I think a lot of founders forget that, like, you know, the first check really is them, and it's their time and it's their commitment to the idea. So I think every founder should see the ideation process similar to the way investors look at writing checks. And I did a lot of research on the investment criteria of famous investors I respected. So I really respect Keith Raboys. I have a lot of respect for David Sachs and those two guys in particular. I mean, I looked at, you know, tens or hundreds of these, but those two guys publish their investment criteria on Twitter. And if you search for Keith Raboy's investment criteria, you'll see that tweet come up, and it's a screenshot off his phone. I'm like, hey, here are the 9 things that I look for in investments. And they're great. I think like 6 or 7 of them I strongly agree with. And like they're mine too. The angel investments that I've done, I made about 80 angel investments. And then David Sachs followed on to that tweet with his own. And, you know, I kind of looked at that and I applied, you know, my own criteria that I've used and research I've done. And just the other thing I did is I made a list of my favorite companies. You know, like I spend a lot of time reading TechCrunch and looking at, you know, companies that I really respect. And there's some companies I look at and I'm like, man, I wish I started that company, like Instacart or DoorDash or Uber. You know, they're just great ideas. And I kind of had this sense of envy about these cool marketplace on-demand consumer businesses that were household names and grew rapidly through geographic expansion. So I was like, okay, well, maybe those should be criteria for what I work on. Like if I take a list of all the companies I really respect and I look at, you know, the founding principles and business models that they have, maybe I should add those as criteria. So I ended up with this list we called the acceptance criteria. And we generated something like 1,000 ideas through, and I could get into that process if you're interested, but we generated a lot of ideas and we ran them all up against the criteria and ended up testing, prior to Gigster, we tested 19 ideas. I mean, we actually built prototypes and launched them.
Wow. You said you could get into that. Can you get into some of the criteria?
Yeah. So I get into criteria. I can get into kind of how we ideated as well.
Yeah. The ideation.
Yeah. Let me touch on that point, the ideation point. But so what we did is it was a very collaborative process because we wanted to ultimately kind of get as much top of funnel as possible and encourage as much creativity as possible. So we had 1 or 2 days a week where the whole team would get together and brainstorm. And I think it was like Mondays and Thursdays or Tuesdays and Fridays or something like that. And sometimes we give people a prompt, like say, hey, like imagine what the world's going to look like in 10 years. What's an app that will exist that doesn't exist today? Or what's a problem that, you know, seems impossible to solve? You know, so we'd make lists like that and we'd go through those and we'd kind of ideate. I just jumped up here. But yeah, we were looking at, you know, I think even what we called these idea vectors. One of them was major stages of life, you know, so like pre-birth, birth, you know, toddler, young adult, old age, death, you know, so we took each of those and we're like, okay, like death, are there any ideas? Like, is there something we could do with mortuaries where they make them more effective? Or, you know, young adulthood, like what are young adults into these days or whatever, right? So, you know, these idea vectors would inspire different, would kind of be these great little brainstorming prompts. Another one was apps that are on the homepage of a smartphone. So you pull up the homepage of your smartphone, photos. Okay, do we have any cool ideas on photos? How do I use photos that may be different than other people in the group? You know, notes, alarm, weather, right? You know, they just, whatever you can do to just jog different ideas out helps. We would also try to be in different environments. So we'd get in an Uber, get in a car, we'd drive to a park we'd never been to before. Or we'd go to like a McDonald's in South Bay and just hang out there all day and work and think and just, you know, just look around us and see what's different about that environment and look at somebody who's buying a burger and imagine, you know, would they want to use this product that we're thinking of building? So I think, yeah, just exposing yourself to different environments, generating a lot of different prompts, that was our kind of high level approach.
Yeah. Yeah. I think some of the best ideas, you know, I think like with Steve Jobs stories, right? Like you're connecting the dots, right? Had he not gone to, you know, learned about type, I think Apple might have, the Apple product or computer might have, you know, not cared about type so much, right? And then it would have not been such a great tool for artists. And then kind of you can see how that goes. Another thing one thing I've always admired about you is, you know, your ability to grow. Yeah, growth is something that I see that, you know, this, if I could call it a superpower, definitely a superpower. How did you grow, you know, kind of in Curiosoft and at Zynga? Talk to us about growth.
Yeah, growth is critical. You know, it's, you know, like if the tree falls in the forest, nobody hears it. Did it fall? No, at least from a business perspective, the answer is no. You want, you know, when your tree falls, you want everybody to hear it. Otherwise, you might as well be doing something else. So yeah, I mean, I would say I'm a very growth focused, growth first CEO. I don't think an idea is good unless it can grow and it has that fundamental ability. That's part of why we looked at businesses that have this kind of geographic expansion nature, because there's a playbook for how to grow those businesses. You know, you look at what DoorDash and Uber and Airbnb and Lyft and Lime and all these, you look at all these services and how they grew, you know, those stories are pretty similar, right? Just like you look at how, you know, different games grew, or how these DTC brands grew. So there's certain like models that the industry uses, and there's different growth models you can build a business off of. You know, DTC, they're heavily engaged in social and user generated content and, you know, profitably buying ads, and, you know, they kind of arbitrage. And if you're acquiring a customer for $25, you know, how much merchandise are they purchasing on the site? So there's, I would say there's a lot of different models, but going back to Zynga, we, you know, there's this term being thrown around these days, a product-led growth. And in fact, Zynga was the epitome of that. You know, what we were good at, and I think the Wall Street Journal quipped at one point that, like, you know, we were a kind of growth, or we were like, you know, we were a growth and product company masquerading as a games company, or like an analytics company masquerading as a games company, I think is what they said. And it was really true. I mean, the early, like the first 100 employees at Zynga, I don't think anybody had game experience at all. Literally, I mean, we actually tried to hire a bunch of game designers at one point, and they quit because they're like, this isn't a games company. You know, and that was a problem, obviously. We had to like try to coax some of them to come back and like address the culture there, because we did want to be a games company. And we even hired a CMO at one point, and I think he was out 2 months later because, you know, we didn't do traditional marketing and we didn't design games in traditional ways. We did product-led growth. So what I mean by that is, like, you go into a game like Farmville, and Farmville is going to say, hey, you know, we had this thing called a lonely cow. Like, hey, a lonely cow has wandered onto your property. It's lost. It's one of your friend's cows. Like, click here to let your friend rescue it. And you click that, it would publish like this feed story on Facebook. And then all your friends would see that and they could collect the cow. And I think we'd let 5 or 10 people have the cow. And after that, it would actually say, sorry, the cow has been claimed. So that drove people to, you know, like look at their friends' feeds and collect as many cows as they possibly could. And they would be clicking on these stories as fast as they could. And it drove people to want to click and share that. We had this other mechanic, we could send your friends gifts. It was kind of similar, you know, like Mafia Wars had this thing where, you know, it basically like the size of your mafia was equal to how many friends you had playing Mafia Wars, which kind of made sense. So if you wanted like 50 members in your mafia, you had to have 50 friends playing. And when you had 50 members in your mafia, you had these extra capabilities because you have a bigger mafia and you can do more fun, cool stuff. You can fight more mafia battles and all what, you know, all the stuff you can do in the game. So people would invite as many friends as they possibly could so they could grow their mafia. And with my first game, which was called Dope Wars, which I did at Curiosoft, it was like, I don't know if you played Drug Wars on like the Palm Pilot or the TI calculator, but it's this game where you kind of buy low, sell high. There's different drugs, like, can buy 5 bags of weed for $7 a bag. You sell it for $10 a bag. You make a $3 spread times the number of bags that you sold. So, you know, it was this kind of like economic simulator with kind of the funny drug dealing spin. And that, you know, the game did super well. I had this trick in there where there was this island, maybe it was like Ibiza or something, where you could go deal drugs, but you couldn't get there unless you had a motorboat. And you couldn't get the motorboat unless you had 10 friends playing. So everybody would invite their friends, they could get the motorboat and they could go like trade drugs in Ibiza, because Ibiza had like, you know, lower prices. So you could go to Ibiza, you buy, and then you come back to like Amsterdam or whatever you sell. So it's just stuff like that. Like what we figured out, and the way I articulated it, I've given talks about gamification. Like, gamification boils down to this: get on a whiteboard and you draw out 3 columns. The column on the left is what you want. So it could be like new users, it could be revenue, whatever. The middle column is, what do you have? And the column on the right is, what do your customers want? And ultimately, any effective gamification is a mapping from the left column to the right column. You've got to map what you want to what your customers want. So, I mean, take a bagel store. The bagel store wants money. They have bagels and their customers want bagels. So it works, right? Everybody's happy. So, you know, if your customers want, you know, if your customers want bagels and you sell frozen yogurt, then you're in trouble. You're not going to make a lot of revenue, right? So you kind of just have to map all those together. And good games do that well. Good games, they look at what do I have? What are the game's features? And what do I want? And what do the customers want? And you kind of build a mapping.
Right. You kind of gate some of those features to incentivize some behavior that you want.
Yeah. Gating is one approach. I think I used to give talks on gamification. I identified something like 30 or 40 different distinct game mechanics that we actually used at Zynga. Okay. I should probably write a book on that at some point. I have it all in Google Docs somewhere, but you know, I was able to identify 30 or 40 different, you know, different mechanics. That there's a lot of ingenuity that went into it. We had, mm-hmm. I think when I was there, we had the best product organization in the world.
Is there a talk on YouTube that I can find?
Probably so. Honestly, like I wouldn't have a specific one to suggest. And that was like eight or nine years ago me. So I don't know, maybe it's embarrassing and not a good
time. No, I'm sure it is very valuable. It worked. I want to say I even played Dope Wars because I definitely played Mafia Wars for sure. Yeah. But it was like, I remember playing some sort of Mafia type game that was pre-Zing. Mm-hmm. And then there was like a Twitter game that was Mafia related.
Yeah. I remember that one. We tried to, I think, do our own Twitter game, but it didn't really work out that well. So we just went back to Facebook.
That was really good. How do you develop that muscle of, you know, kind of product-led growth? I think there's that process that you outlined, you know, the three columns, that's great. But how do you, build that muscle and think like that all the time?
I think it's a cultural thing, you know, maybe first and foremost, you know, it just gets back to, as a founding team, how do you build your growth organization? If you want to call it growth, you know, some people are like, okay, well, growth means marketing, and marketing means I plug my credit card into Facebook, I plug my credit card into Google, and you know, I make some ads and I route people to my landing page, ... success, right? And that's very expensive. Yeah, that adds up fast because you're always competing with other people for those clicks. You know, so the best companies will find free distribution paths, and also proprietary, because you want a competitive advantage over your customers. So, you know, in terms of building that muscle, I mean, you look at your product and you ask yourself, how can I get people who are using this product to invite other people to use this product? And one way to do that is to make the product better when your friends are using it. I mean, and that you might think, oh, well, that's just for social games, right? No, it's for everything. Like Dropbox, if your friends aren't using Dropbox, it kind of sucks because you can't send them Dropbox files. So that's why Dropbox grew so virally, because, you know, if I get Dropbox and I want to send you a file, it's like, hey, Peck, you have to install Dropbox. And then you do it. You're like, what is this new thing? So it's just getting free marketing like all day long, 24/7. Google Docs is similar, right? SaaS kind of works in that way too. Like if, you know, I still remember when I first saw Slack, there was this engineer I was working with who's like, hey, Roger, we should use Slack. And I'm like, what is that? You know, and he's like, oh, it's really cool. I used it in my last company. And then he installed it and I had to install it. And suddenly we have like 10 seats. And then I left that company and joined another company and I brought Slack to that new company, right? So, you know, there's this nature of, if you have a product that gets better when people use it, when your friends use it, then you can kind of take these product-led growth approaches where you build growth features into the product. Obviously, social networks do this. There's a great talk by one of Facebook's early heads of growth. This guy, I think his name's Andy Johns, but he talks about how, you know, when he was at Facebook, the goal was to grow Facebook 2% a week. And that's 200 basis points, right? So he had a team of like 30 or 40 brilliant people. And their job was just to like figure out ideas, you know, and maybe, you know, this person has an idea to grow by 10 bips, and this person has a 5 bip idea, and this person has a 12 bip idea, you know, and then the engineers and designers and everybody goes and builds that, and you A/B test it. You just have to add it up to 200 bips by the end of the week. So just this cool kind of frenetic, there's a cultural aspect to it too, where you're taking a very almost scientific approach. I think Facebook would hire people with like physics PhDs, because really anybody who's smart can just look at a set of inputs and produce the right set of outputs. And actually somebody who's a total outsider might have a better perspective or new perspective that somebody who's like a growth expert wouldn't even have. So I know Zynga did that as well. We hired people out of hedge funds on Wall Street. We hired people directly out of like MBA, really analytical MBA programs. We also hired people with physics degrees, really people with growth expertise who can do that scientific, you know, hypothesis kind of to conclusion motion, end up being really successful in growth, but you've got to build it into the culture early.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked to a growth designer at Netflix. And one of the things I learned was, you know, everything is an A-B test. You can't have it. In fact, it's a special case when you don't want to A-B test something and you have to kind of turn it off because it's on by default and everything's a learning, everything's an experiment. And that's their framework. I think that's you can generalize that that's a good framework, is always having a mindset for that.
Yeah, I mean, even with Netflix, you look at product-led growth in Netflix, and like, you know, I'm not inviting my friends to Netflix. It's not a game like that necessarily. I mean, I might do it for a referral bonus, but there's other nuanced things that can kind of create product-led growth. Like, you know, early Lyft cars, they had that pink mustache on it. So like, you notice the car when it's out, and maybe the product team decided to do that at Lyft, who knows? But you know, that one little tweak made it really noticeable. When your Peloton gets delivered, and that big Peloton truck drives up and all your neighbors like pull up their curtain, they're like, what is that? And they go Google for it, right? Like that's free growth. And then coming back to Netflix, they have this cool feature where I think you get like a text message or you get like a push notification when one of your favorite shows has new episodes. And I swear I've been like at dinner before and it's like Game of Thrones has like the new season of Game of Thrones is live. And I'll be at dinner with like five friends. And I'll be like, oh my God, guys, like the new Game of Thrones, it just dropped, you know? And then everybody takes out their phone and they're like, oh shoot, I need to like make a reminder to go watch this, you know? And if there's somebody in that group who doesn't have Netflix or I guess HBO in this case, they'll go sign up.
Right. Creating that environment so that it's people start to know about it. Enterprise growth is maybe a little different. Can you talk to me about how you grew Gigster?
Yeah. So early days, it was just a lot of grassroots kind of brand building, for lack of a better word. We got a lot of early press and there was a lot of word of mouth. Like I remember one of our early goals was we really wanted to own Silicon Valley. Like we wanted everybody in Silicon Valley to know who we were and to like us and think we were great. Because my theory is that everybody who's in tech who doesn't live in Silicon Valley has a friend in Silicon Valley. So if I live in Boston and I'm a tech guy in Boston, or I live in Miami, I have a friend in Silicon Valley. And I'm going to ask that friend when I need development services. And I might be like, hey, do you know any good developers? And they'll be like, yeah, you should use Impeccable. You should use Gigster, right? And I just wanted to own the zeitgeist and own like the brains, you know, that part of the brain of people in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I got like a, you know, my license plate said Gigster on it. And I got stopped in traffic once or twice. People like, oh, hey, I've heard of Gigster. Are you affiliated with Gigster? And it was just cool. Like, you know, seeing, you know, running into people who are familiar with it. And I'd be in a bar meeting somebody and they'd be like, oh yeah, I've heard of Gigster. I saw you guys on TechCrunch. That's super cool. And they'd like repeat the vision back to me. So I think if you find a core group of like influential people and you get them obsessed with your product and excited about your brand, that's one approach to kind of B2B and enterprise growth. You know, obviously a lot of people have outbound sales teams and they'll buy ads. I think that can get really expensive, especially if you're going after a very general audience. And that was a huge mistake we made at Gigster, actually. I wanted to be like all things to all people. And we do all types of development for anybody, anywhere, any industry. And if I could go back and do it again, I would have, you know, I would have done the whole Peter Thiel thing. I would have built small monopolies. I'd build a bunch of little monopolies. You glue those together. Suddenly one day you have this really big company. And so I would have said, hey, I'm going to start with like oil and gas. And we're only going to do certain types of apps for oil and gas. And then I would have like gone to all the industry conferences and events and journals. And I would have bought ads, you know, because when you get that specific and that targeted, it's a lot less expensive to reach the audience. I mean, sure. If you get targeted enough, like oil and gas companies with greater than $1 billion in revenue, there's like 10. Just email them all yourself, right? Yeah, you don't even have to buy ads. So when you get targeted enough, you can develop like expertise and this like kind of institutional knowledge and how to win in those markets. And then you take that and you roll out the next market, go from oil and gas to, you know, aerospace or to certain parts of defense. And, you know, I mean, there still is going to be that effort. You've got to get out there. And I can't tell you how many conferences I went to where I set up the folding table and I had the Gigster banner behind me and I had business cards sitting there. And I just was on my feet all day meeting people and telling the story. And I had an iPad and I was trying to get them to sign up for Gigster. So it's just, I mean, the early days look like a lot of that, But then hopefully if you can get the kind of small monopolies thing going, you can, you can get to a point where you can raise some venture capital, hire a real marketing team at scale.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a similar journey to Impeccable where, you know, as we've grown over the years, we rather than trying to do everything and take on every type of client, we niche down and figure out what's, you know, one, what's our most profitable client. And then two, you know, what are we really good at that we can just crank out over and over. And rather than trying to, you know, spray and pray and do everything and be a jack of all trades, where we've kind of niched down to essentially enterprise SaaS software design and development. So yeah, it's a really valuable lesson that, you know, focus and niche, you know, the riches are in the niches or something is the saying. So thanks for that. I can see that lesson applying to agencies as well. Well, Roger, do you want to, is there any promo code as we kind of get to the top of the hour that someone can use if they want to check out Made Renovation?
We don't have promo codes. It's a great question. I totally should have one. But if you either email me directly, Roger, R-O-G-E-R, at maderenovation.com. That's M-A-D-E. renovation.com. You can just email me directly and I'll connect you to a member of our sales team and I'll kind of tell them to give you a special discount, or you can contact our sales team and mention that you heard me on the podcast. We're currently live in SF and LA. So, or also Orange County. And I think maybe San Diego, we might've launched already, but if you're in any of those markets, we'd love to renovate your bathroom. We actually have a promo running this month. It's around $1,000. Maybe it's even higher than $1,000, but I'll give you an extra $200 off if you come through that channel.
Sweet. Thank you so much, Roger.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Founders with Peck. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel. If you leave us a review, I'll be sure to shout it out. And if you have any questions, you can tweet me on Twitter.